Welcome to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exists to help people find their way back to God. This week, we continue our series called Heroes and Villains with a message about a somewhat obscure person in the Old Testament named Ehud. But before we get to that, here's a couple things we need you to know about. Sign-ups for Backyard VBS are still open, both for host families and for children who want to attend. Please visit harborchurches.org/VBS for more information. We are still looking for more volunteers for our Youth Week this summer. You can visit harborchurches.org/Youth Week for more information. We are specifically still looking for registered nurses and adults who are available throughout the day for the entire duration of the week. And lastly, as the Harbor Churches ends its fiscal year here at the end of June, we would ask that you would prayerfully consider a gift. We know that this last year has been hard on a lot of us, but we would ask you to consider supporting the ministry of South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, which will allow us to not only continue providing you with this podcast and other online materials, but also allow you to become a part of the daily ministry of the community of South Harbor Church. Making a gift online is easy. Simply head to harborchurches.org/give, and please know that we genuinely appreciate your generosity. And now, having said that, let's go to Pastor Tim as he brings us a somewhat strange message on Ehud.
All right, if you have a Bible, we're going to be in Judges chapter 3. Judges chapter 3. And I'm going to give a disclaimer on this one. This one is a different kind of sermon. So one of the first pieces of advice that was given to me when I began preaching. Right before my very first sermon, my brother caught me. He's 2 years younger than me. And he stopped me and he said, "Hey, Tim, here's the deal. Make it good." That was his advice. Make it good. Or he said, "Make it really bad." Because everyone likes like good, interesting sermons. And we all kind of enjoy watching a train wreck. He goes, "Whatever you do, just don't be boring." So, and I've had that voice in my head for a while now. Don't make the Bible boring. The Bible is not boring. Don't make it boring. And so, you know, we try different things. Sometimes they work. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they verge on train wreck. Other times they're really kind of fun. A couple years ago, I had one of those kinds of ideas that I was nervous about. I'm like, okay, this is either going to be interesting and fun, or it's going to be really embarrassing and I'll just kind of sneak out the back door. Either way, it'll be fun for me at some level. It'll at least be memorable. The idea was we were working through the David and Goliath story. And, you know, there's been, I've preached dozens of sermons on David and Goliath. It's a familiar story. Most people, if you grew up in the church or church adjacent, you've heard stories on it. So I thought, how do we come at this story from a different angle? And I had this idea that what we would do is I would run the whole sermon like I was pitching a TV show to you. Some of you were here for this. I created a title for it. I called it "A Rush of Blood to the Head," based on, you know, because he gets hit in the forehead, based on the Coldplay album, the best Coldplay album. And I created a graphic for it, and I talked about like marketing and how we'd market it and the graphics, and we talked about the DVD when it went to, because it would go to DVD. I don't know if DVDs are even being sold anymore, but that at that point, 5 years ago, they were. And we talked about all of that. And I thought, you know, actually, after the service, somebody emailed me and said, "Hey, my nephew is an intern in Hollywood. I'm going to tell him about your sermon." I'm still waiting on the phone call. I pretty sure it wasn't that good. But what I want to do this morning is the story we're looking at today. Now, this one, I get it. TV shows require a lot of attention span, and I get a TV show is hard. Okay, so I get it. But this one, maybe what we could do with the story we're going to look at is we could create a movie out of this story. I mean, it's got all the best bits of a movie. It's got drama. It's got suspense. It's got murder. It's got like a deep teaching about like what it means to be human and follow our God. Like, it's got all the best stuff. And so I figured on this Father's Day, let's have a little bit of fun. I wanna build a movie plot together. I'm gonna pitch you an idea. It's definitely rough at this point, but I'm just gonna pitch you a movie, and we'll see. We'll see maybe if there's something in here. The movie itself will be on a man known as Ehud. Let me hear you say Ehud. Yeah, Ehud the judge. His story is found in Judges chapter 3. So if we're building a movie, the first shot you have to think about is how do you open, right? How do you open the movie? And the opening sequence matters, especially in this one. And I recognize in this story, the hardest scene to build is going to be the opening scene. Like the question we had to wrestle with is how do you orient your room right away? Because people are going to be coming in from all these different experiences, and you need everyone in the room to kind of all of a sudden realize where they are in history, understand kind of what's going on, and you need them to lean in and be interested in it. So how do we do that? Well, this is not the easiest part, but this story is found in the book of Judges. Judges, that period in time lasts about 300 years. The story before this is the story of the Exodus out of Egypt, and the story after this is the story of the kings. So we have this 300-year period where things are quite bloody, quite violent, and quite chaotic. How do you show that in an opening sequence? I don't know. If you back up from the book of Judges and just kind of see the book of Judges as a whole, what you notice is there's this pattern that runs through the book. The pattern goes something like this. God says to the people, hey, you're going to enter into the promised land, the land of Israel. And when you do, the temptation is going to be to intermarry with the people there. And slowly, when you do that, you will find yourself bowing down to foreign gods and worshiping foreign idols. Don't do that. If you do that, I will let you have your way. I'll let you worship them, and I'll let them defend you. And so you see this pattern of they come into the land, and then they sin, they disobey God, and eventually they're intermarrying, they're bowing down to foreign statues, and then a foreign nation comes in, and they kind of take them over. The people cry out to God, God, save us, help us. God raises, here's their cry, raises up a judge. Now, when you hear judge, by the way, a judge is a military leader. So think less Judy, more Patton. Okay, less judge. I mean, although Judy, I'd bring her in a battle. She's ferocious. So a judge is like a military. So raise up a judge. The judge then, in the name of God, will like go to war for the people, bring a season of stability. The people then, again, the pattern will repeat. The people then, the stability will come. They'll forget God. They bow down to foreign gods. God then has to, the people cry out. God gives them another judge. The judge is raised up and defends Israel. And there's a season of stability. And then the pattern repeats again and again. The book of Judges is like a giant circle. It's just repeats, 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 repeats. Some refer to this as the sin cycle, right? People sin, and then this is how God meets them in their sin. I heard recently someone referred to this as the redemption cycle, which I like way better because the sin cycle focuses on our inability, but the redemption cycle focuses on who our God is and how he keeps meeting us in our failures. I like that way better. But somehow, I think in our opening sequence, we got to show that pattern, and it's got to be quick. Let me read you just so you get an idea in the story. So if you got your Bible, Judges 3, verse 7, let me see if you can catch the pattern here. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asherahs. Those are foreign gods. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishpah, king of Aram-Naharaim, to whom the Israelites were subject for 8 years. But when they cried out to the Lord, he raised up for them a deliverer, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, who saved them. The Spirit of the Lord came on him, so that he became Israel's judge and went to war. The Lord gave Cushan, king of Aram, into the hands of Othniel, who overpowered him. So the land had peace for 40 years until Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Do you see the pattern? And because they did this evil thing, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel. Remember that name, Eglon. He's going to be in our story. Getting the Ammonites and the Amalekites to join him, Eglon came and attacked Israel, and they took possession of the city of palms. The Israelites were subject to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. Again, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and he gave them a deliverer. Do you see the pattern? Now, again, if we're going to film this, I don't know how to film this necessarily. I do know that it matters. Like, I don't know, maybe you just wait and you do like a prequel and it's like, that's the story. But I feel like for me, I would want to start, if I was going to put this in a movie, I'd want to start here because this actually feels like life, doesn't it? How many times have you found yourself going on a mission trip or listening to a sermon or listening to a song on the radio and finding yourself saying, God, I'm in. Like, it's like the Spirit speaks right to you and says, get, like, don't, you've lost the fire, and you commit. You know what? When I get home from this mission trip, I'm going to read my Bible every single day. I'm going to be in prayer every single day. I'm going to commit to serving in ways I've never served before. And you're passionate. You mean it. It's not that you're insincere, but slowly you find yourself falling away, crying back out to God, God rescuing you again. Is that not the story of our lives? Like, is this just my life? I once had a mentor, because he said, hey, Tim, how's your faith right now? He asked that question, and I said, you know, right now I just feel like it's stagnant, if I'm honest. Like, I just feel like it's stagnant. And he stopped me right there, and he goes, Tim, I never want you to say that again, because there is no such thing about standing still in your faith. You are either walking forward, or if you think you're standing still, you're probably falling back. And sure enough, you know, like, months can go by and you realize, wow, I have not prayed in forever. It's been months. So I think, like, it's really important, if we're going to capture this, that we kind of get that, like, spinning wheel somehow in the beginning. I have no idea how to film that. Let me know if you can figure it out. Here's my best proposal, though. Okay, this is what I'm going to propose. Here's how I think we should do it. I think we should picture, like, present time, a grandpa and his 16-year-old granddaughter. Okay, so that's like the scene that we start with. And if we can afford it in our budget, which apparently right now maybe we can't, but if we could, if we could afford it in our budget, I'm thinking we need some. So as you're going to see, the story itself is going to be, it's going to play more probably to the male audience by and large. It's pretty violent of a story. It's got some weird stuff. So we probably need to balance the scales a little bit. So I don't know. Who do you think? Like, George Clooney, Robert Redford, one of those. Are those guys still okay? I don't know. I should have Googled. Did they get canceled? I have no idea. So, but let's say it's George Clooney, because he was Batman, of course. For the granddaughter, I legitimately cannot think of one 16-year-old or any teenage actresses. I know that says more about me than about them, but I cannot think of one. But the person that comes to my mind, because this person's going to have a little bit of sass, a little bit of, like, spunk to her. The person that comes to my mind is, we need the modern equivalent of Nelly Olson. Remember Nelly Olson? While you were all binging Tiger King, I was binging Little House on the Prairie. That show lives up. Nelly Olson from Little House on the Prairie. Some modern day version of Nelly Olson, because we need some Nelly Olson sass to this thing. Okay, so here's how we start it. Grandpa Clooney and Nelly Olson, she's got an issue. Grandpa, why do you do that religious stuff? It's not relevant. It's antiquated. It's barbaric. It's really violent. The Bible is really violent. We live in a new world. We live in a new era. Why are you still doing the Bible stuff? That's what's going on in her life. Now, deeper than that, what Grandpa knows, because he loves his granddaughter, is that it's not just that she doesn't like the Bible, she also is starting to not like herself. We've all been 16, we know what that's like, right? She doesn't like who she is, and she doesn't feel like anyone at, like, none of the girls at school give her attention, none of the boys at school even look at her. She feels like she's just different. And because of that, she goes looking for identity in another group of friends who are not the kind of friends that a loving grandpa would want his granddaughter to hang out with. So this is like the opening sequence. Grandpa, why all the violence? Why do we still do this? And Grandpa says to her, can I tell you a story? And Grandpa Clooney, who loves the Bible, he looks for the most bloody story in the entire Bible to tell. Because if I could tell her the worst of the worst, the bloodiest of the bloodiest stories, well, then I could help her see that there's more going on than just the blood. There's actually more to the story. If we just write it off because of the violence, we'll miss out on the power of the story. Opening sequence. Then you do the credits and then the wheel of, like, history. How's that? Does that make sense? Is that okay for an opening sequence? We're up against attention spans, which, I mean, let's be honest, our attention spans are not very long anymore. And Netflix is running shows about hybrid deer children and baking muffins. And I mean, we're up against some, the competition is weird, but it's ferocious. So we may have to work on opening sequence, but I think like what we really need to do is we need to get people situated with what we're dealing with. Now, that's opening sequence. Here's scene one. Scene one, I'm calling Ehud the Southpaw. Ehud the Southpaw. It begins, source material for the scene is verse 15. Verse 15 says this. Again, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, remember the circle, and he gave them a deliverer, Ehud, a left-handed man, the son of Gera the Benjaminite. Okay, pause there. Here's our hero, or is he? Here's our hero, Ehud. Ehud, we're told two things about Ehud. First thing we're told is he's a lefty. He's a southpaw. Now, who's lefty here? Yes. We had an 8 o'clock service. It was a decently full room, and I was the only lefty in that room. So solidarity. Now, the word for left-handed in this passage is a Hebrew word. Say iter. Iter. Iter literally means bound or impeded on the right. Now, there's some debate among scholars about what this exactly means. Some people will argue that Ehud is physically disabled on the right, that he's got a physical disability. So some will say that that's actually what's going on in the story. Others will argue, as the NIV translators of this translation have, that it's not that he's physically disabled, he's just culturally disabled because he's left-handed, right? Because culturally, to be left-handed was taboo. Now, understand, the Hebrew culture was a communal culture, and the center of a community was the dinner table. And the way you would eat dinner is you would rip off bread and you would dip it in the bowl with the people you eat with. It's kind of like when your friend orders nachos and you're like, I'm just going to have one. And everyone, it's that moment, right? Everyone kind of reaches in and dips in the same bowl. Jesus at the Last Supper says, the one who dips in the bowl with me will betray me, right? So it's communal. Now, why does that matter? Well, your right hand, your dominant hand for most people, would be the hand you eat with. Your left hand, in a culture pre-toilet paper, was your cleaning hand, your wiping hand. Now, you can imagine if you ordered the nachos and somebody's wiping hand was to reach into the nacho tray. That's a culturally taboo. And so left-handed people were seen as other, as less than. We've come a long way. We still have some work to do, lefties, right? Would you agree? Especially writing. Like, we got to figure out a way to write. Maybe typing is the solution to this, but I remember, left-handed people, you all have your horror stories. Mine is the ACT. So I had the horror stories of the ACT. Remember the ACT test? So my parents and my teachers had all basically threatened and said, like, hey, if you don't do well on this ACT, you're not going to get into the college you want. You won't get a scholarship into the college you want. And if you don't get a scholarship into the college you want, well, then you're not gonna get the job you want. And if you don't get the job you want, you won't meet the spouse that you want. And if you don't meet the spouse that you want, you'll be living in a gutter. So you better do well on the ACT. So I had taken the prep courses. I had gotten the booklets at my house. I studied hard for this thing. And then the test itself comes, and I've got my number 2 lead pencil, and I'm taking the test, the essay section, and I realize my paper is becoming one giant gray blob as my hand drags along it, and they don't let you bring a lot of stuff in that room, and so I had to make do with what I had, and in my head I'm thinking, if I turn in a gray blob, they're going to think, oh, who's this guy? He can't even turn in a clean sheet of paper. He's out. So I'm like, I got to clean this up somehow. So I did what you would do. I looked at my hand, and then I licked it. Yeah, I know. Ew. It's not as bad as it was. All right, it's not as bad as it was, but it's still. Ehud is a lefty. Okay, he's a southpaw. First bit about Ehud. Second piece of Ehud is we're told a detail that feels obscure and meaningless, but remember, the details matter. We're told that he's from the tribe of Benjamin. He's a Benjaminite. There are 12 tribes. He's from Benjamin's tribe. Now, why does that matter? Well, Benjamin's tribe was known for a thing. In fact, the word Benjamin literally means son of the right hand. He's from a tribe who was known for being ferocious fighters with the sword on their right hand. So now you've got a guy who's a lefty in a club, in a tribe of all righties, known for being right-handed. It's not just about smudging your paper. This is a big deal. He's the only. Have you ever been in a space and realized, I think I'm the only? It's a pretty isolating space, isn't it? Is it not? To be in a space where you realize, I think in this space, maybe it is a physical disability. I'm the only person here with a physical disability. The room isn't even set up with my awareness of my, like, they didn't even think about me when they designed the space. Maybe you've been in that spot, or somebody you love is in that spot. Maybe it's you're the only single person in a space. All the friends have gotten, like, hitched up, and you're the only single person left. Or you're the only divorced person in a group of friends. You're the only recovering addict in a party. You're the only person of your race in a space. Only person of your size or weight in a space. You ever feel like you're the only? I'm very aware of in what the circles I run in. So in the pastor world, it's a pretty male-dominated culture. And I'm very aware that there are several times where I will look around a room and there is just one female in this room. And just to think how intimidating that could be, to be the only can feel isolating. And Ehud, in this moment, he is the only. The only can feel like a liability. It can feel like the thing that makes him unique also makes him weak. Now, if we're filming this one, that's what we got to capture in this first scene. We've got to help people see that Ehud is not a flat, two-dimensional character in some made-up story. This is a real guy with real issues, surrounded by a group of people who all took pride in being a certain way, and he just isn't. Okay, we got to build that up. That's scene one. Oh, we got to move along. Okay, scene two. I'm calling scene two Stones and Secrets. Stones and Secrets. Here's the source material, verse 15. The Israelites sent him, that is Ehud, with tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, tribute, don't think like Hunger Games. Tribute is often when an oppressed group has to show that they're subservient to an oppressor, they would bring some kind of a peace offering. Often it was like a fattened calf of some sort. And it was a tribute. It was, we're here, we're loyal. Now, so he's bringing that. Ehud had made a double-edged sword about a cubit long, which he strapped to his right thigh under his clothing. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab, who was a very fat man. After Ehud had presented the tribute, he sent on their way those who had carried it, but on reaching the stone images near Gilgal, he himself went back to Eglon and said, "Your Majesty, I have a secret message for you." The king said to his attendants, "Leave us," and they all left. Okay, pause there. Cut. End of scene. Now, we were introduced to Eglon earlier. Remember, he's the king of Moab. Moab, I think I have a map. Moab is to the east of Israel. It's probably way buried in the slide deck. Don't worry about it. Oh, there it is. Moab is to the east of Israel, and so he's from this tribe. He takes over the city of Palms. The city of Palms is another way of saying Jericho. The city of Jericho, not the middle-aged wrestler, Chris Jericho, in case you were confused. But the reason why that city matters is you can see it's right by the Jordan River, and whoever controls Jericho controls the road to Jerusalem. So it's a big deal. He takes that over and has been on the throne for 18 years, this guy Eglon. Now, there is an inside joke hidden inside of this story that the author wants us to catch something about Eglon. The name Eglon comes from the word egel, which means calf. And then what's the detail we're giving about Eglon? He's a very fat man, they say. And so the picture they give is, here you've got this guy bringing a fattened calf as tribute to a guy who is a fattened calf ready to be slaughtered. I know, right? It's a weird story. Now, I think we got to be really careful for filming this because we do not want to body shame. A lot of us wrestle with weight issues. We do not want to body shame. So I think to be safe, if we're going to cast Eglon, I'm going to say we cast him as Jabba the Hutt, right? Like he's just like a slug man. Because that's really what they want you to catch. This guy's like, he's like, it's over the top exaggeration. Now, so that's Eglon. We also have Ehud, and Ehud has made a sword and strapped it to his right thigh because he's left-handed and he would draw from the right thigh. So he straps a sword to the right thigh. The sword, we're told, is a cubit long. I know we all know cubits, but just in case you don't know what a cubit is about 18 inches. So from your elbow to the end of your finger, that's a cubit. So he's got a giant, he's packing some heat. And he comes in to see the king with tribute. You get the sense he's got an ulterior mission here, right? He's going to go to the king with a sword strapped to him, and he's going to take care of business. But then we read, he gets to the king, he gives the tribute, and he leaves. It's almost like the author wants you to think, wait, is he chickening out? Is he not going to do it? Now, we'll get to the violence piece in just a moment, so just stay with the story. Let the story be a story for now. It feels like he's going to kill this guy, and he doesn't. Until he gets to Gilgal, where he sees stone images. Now, most scholars think those stone images are probably the Baals and the Asherahs, like the pagan gods. He sees the stone images, and he turns, and he goes back, and he says, I got a secret message for the king. Raising the question, what was it about the stone images? Is it simply these are pagan gods? Maybe. But maybe the location matters. If we're filming this, I think we really need to get this turning moment. This is a moment in the story. What else happened in Gilgal? There's a story that happens involving stones in Gilgal. Do you know the story? Israel has wandered the desert for 40 years. They finally get to the promised land. A guy by the name of Joshua is going to lead the charge in. They cross the Jordan River on dry ground, and each tribe grabs a stone, and they bring that stone to a city, and they set up the stones in this particular city as a way to remember who God is. That city is Gilgal. Now, why that's interesting is there is a speech that Joshua gives to the people when they enter the city. There's a speech he makes. Here's the speech. Joshua 3. On the 10th day of the first month, the people went up from the Jordan and camped at Gilgal on the eastern border of Jericho, the city of palms, not to be confused with the middle-aged wrestler, Chris Jericho. And Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. He said to the Israelites, in the future, when your descendants ask their parents, what do these stones mean? Tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we crossed over. Now here's the detail. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God. What do the stones, according to Joshua, what are the stones there to remind you of? The what of the Lord is powerful? Hand of the Lord. What is Ehud's weakness in his mind? His hand. I think this is the moment in the story, if you're going to film this, you almost have to get, like, he chickens out, he doesn't do what he was going to do, because, you know, like, he's a left-handed guy, let's let one of the right-handed guys, they're better with the sword, let's let them deal with it. And so he gets out, and then he sees the stones. I picture, like, you've got the Baals and the Asherahs right alongside of these standing stones of Joshua, almost as a way to mock them. And he gets to the stones, and he thinks, here's the speech of Joshua. The hand, all people will know that the hand of the Lord is strong. And he gets there and he says, it's not about my hand. It's not about my ability. He can do it. He can do it. God, your hand is strong. Mine is not. I'll do it. And he turns. Then he gets to the king and he says to the bodyguards, I have a secret message for the king. Now, I would say there we flash back to George Clooney, Grandpa Clooney and Nelly, because we really need, this is not just about fitting in, right? The reason he would be telling the story to his granddaughter is the same reason that we would tell it to our kids. It's the things that make you unique do not make you weak. In fact, your uniqueness is not your weakness. It may just be the thing God uses. Now, he gets back to the guards. Will the guards let him in? Let's read the story. That's cut scene two. Scene three. This is a scene I'm calling, now that's a catchphrase. Scene three, now that's a catchphrase. Verse 20. Ehud then approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his palace and said, I have a message from God for you. As the king rose from his feet, Ehud reached with his left hand, drew the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. Even the handle sank in after the blade, and his bowels discharged. This is the Bible. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it. Then Ehud went out to the porch. He shut the doors of the upper room behind him, and he locked them. Okay, end scene, cut scene. It's a sin to make the Bible boring. This book is like, think about the lines, all the gross, and his bowels discharged, the fat closed over it, even the handle sank in. But how about his catchphrase? I love his catchphrase. He gets to the king and he says, I have a message from God for you. Like, that's his catchphrase. That's way better than my spidey senses are tingling. This is a better catchphrase. He's less Steve Urkel and more Stefan Urkel, right? Like, this is the kind of, no family members. This is like, I have a message from God. Now, the question is, how does he get to do what he gets to do here? Why does he get to do this? Actually, I'm going to read you how some of the most refined, respected, elite Bible scholars, the people who use all the big words and are really good at making the interesting stories boring, even they can't make this story boring. Let me read you how the InterVarsity Press Old Testament Background Commentary, which is it's good content, it's one of the most respected, and it can be a bit of a snooze to read. Let me read you how they describe this scene. Since the blade was made to be punched into its victim, it would not have had a cross piece, only a grip or wrap surface for the wielder to hold. Thus, it could be forced completely into the body of Eglon, killing him quickly. And very little blood would result from what, in essence, was a corked wound. Like so many other factors in this narrative, this was an unusual weapon, used by a left-handed man and designed for a single purpose, assassination. It's got like this dramatic flair to the whole story. But now, if we're going to film this, here's how I propose we film this. Because there's a question that gets under the story. If you pay attention, I don't think we could write this better than the writer writes it. This they give you the clues. He's a left-handed man, right thigh, from the right-handed tribe of Benjamin. He's a left-handed man with a sword on his right thigh, left-handed man sword on the right thigh. It comes up again and again. It's almost like pan camera to left hand, pan camera to sword on right thigh. Back and forth, back and forth. Why? Because if you're Ehud, to get to the king of your enemy, you are going to have to go through the guards. How does he get through the guards? Well, the guards are going to pat you down, right? They're going to make sure you're not here to do anything. You're not going to assassinate the king. So they're going to pat you down. Now, most people, strong people they knew, we're right-handed people, so you're going to pat down the left thigh to make sure there's nothing on the left thigh. How does he get past the guards? His uniqueness is not a weakness, right? They don't even think to check. Guy's weak. Like, their assumption is this guy, if there's nothing on the left thigh, he's not here to do any, there's no left-handed person who could do anything. So I say we pan back and forth, I have a message for you. Now, by the way, this is a message I wish I would have internalized earlier. His uniqueness is not his weakness. It's no secret to many of you, but high school was a really hard season, and I didn't fit in. I remember the cafeteria feeling really lonely. And I was too skinny in high school. I was too quiet in high school, too uncoordinated for sports. I went through a real season of despair. And am I worth anything? I wish I would have known then. And if you're in high school or middle school or college, I wish I would have known then that the things that I hated, I'll use the word hate, it's a strong word, but I hated about myself then. I wish I would have known that those would be the things that I'm most proud of now. right? I had to work hard to not stutter in front of people. I now do this. I don't think I would have done this had I not been able to preach like I can, like had I not had to work on communication and speaking and actually like standing in front of people and practicing saying my words because I was so, your uniqueness is not a weakness. It just may be the thing that God uses. Scene four. I'm calling this scene a bit of comedic relief, pun intended. So Eglon is now dead. Ehud has to get. I know I'm having fun with this. Maybe you're not. Ehud is now dead. Eglon is now dead. Ehud has got to get out of there. And then we read this, verse 24. After he had gone, the servants came and found the doors of the upper room locked. They said he must be relieving himself in the inner room of his palace. They waited to the point of embarrassment. But when he did not open the doors of the room, they took a key and unlocked them. There they saw their lord fallen to the floor dead. Okay, end scene. There they saw the fallen to the floor dead. So Eglon's servants are waiting outside of the door. Like, where is he? He must be using the facilities. Now, I'm assuming they knocked, which, by the way, if someone's in the bathroom and you knock, all of us who've ever been in that spot, which is all of us, there is a way we respond in that moment, right? When somebody knocks on the door, every single one of us goes, somebody's in here. The human being is using the facility. Please go away. It's never like, I'm in here. No, it's always, someone's here. He didn't do this. They should have known. Now, while this is happening, while they're waiting, like, okay, what's going on? Ehud makes his escape. Now, I picture like the Shawshank Redemption. Now, if you've not seen the Shawshank Redemption, spoiler alert, and don't get mad at me. It's been on for 30 years. Like, you had time. But you know the scene at the end where he crawls through the wall and in through the sewer system and stands in the rain? We hear the story, and it's like he makes his way to the porch. All of it is euphemism in the story. The story, the way he gets out, and again, our good friends at the InterVarsity Press Bible Commentary will go into detail about this, but the way he gets out is by removing the toilet seat and crawling through the sewers. That's how Ehud gets out. Actually, let me read you IVP's description. Again, I cannot overstate that these are some of the most respected Bible scholars there are. This is how they describe it. There were apparently doors which separated this private room from the larger area, and since it was the king's private meeting area, it probably contained a toilet facility, which was at times a display of pride. Thus, when Eglon drew Ehud up the stairs and into this room, closing and locking the door behind them, Ehud was able to dispatch him in private. Don't you love it they say dispatch him? It's a very, like, just. Okay. He was then able to escape by removing the toilet seat and descending through the floor into the latrine below. The NIV translates it porch. And out through the janitor's door into the larger audience room. His departure through the portico would not have aroused the guards waiting there, and they would have been slow to investigate the king's absence due to the fecal smell emanating from his inner chamber. That's why, is he relieving himself? I can smell something coming out. Now, just in case you're wondering how that smell comes out, the IVP, InterVarsity Bible Commentary, is going to tell us. At this point, when he had stabbed Eglon, the murdered man's anal sphincter exploded, creating, I cannot exaggerate enough, these are the smartest Bible scholars, creating a smell similar to that associated with the bowel movement. Eglon's guards hesitated to interrupt the king while he was relieving himself and thus gave Ehud time to escape and rally his troops. Hashtag you. Scene four. Okay, scene five. This is where it all has to come together. So scene five's got to like pull all this together. So do I, apparently. Verse 26. While they waited, Ehud got away. He passed by the stone images and escaped Sisera. When he arrived there, he blew a trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hills, with him leading them. Follow me, he ordered, for the Lord has given Moab, your enemy, into your hands. So they followed him down and took possession of the fords of the Jordan that led to Moab. They allowed no one to cross over. At that time, they struck down about 10,000 Moabites, all vigorous and strong. Not one of them escaped. Okay, now, this scene is really important. Really important, because we hear here that not only does he start to realize his uniqueness is not a weakness, not only is his own story transformed, God can use me. Big deal when we learn that. But he also in this moment realizes that it's not just about him being a hero for his own sake. He becomes a leader. Follow me, he says. And if you keep reading in Judges 20, let me just read you it. Judges 20, it says, among all these, so this is several generations later, talking about the tribe of Benjamin. Among all these soldiers, there were 700 select troops who were left-handed, each of whom could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 swordsmen, all of them fit for battle. So you still have 400,000 right-handed soldiers, but you also, a few generations later, have left-handed people who can sling a stone and not miss. I wonder if they gather around their campfires and they tell the story of Ehud. And all of these kids who thought that their life was worthless now say, maybe I can play a role too. It's been my experience that when we finally come to own the fact that in the hands of our God, whose hand is powerful, when we finally own the fact that our uniqueness is not a weakness, it's then that we can do some serious leadership. It's been my experience that the people who have been the most able to help somebody who's an addict work through their addiction has been former addicts, recovering addicts. So in my experience, I've got somebody on my phone that I'll call anytime someone loses a child because they've lost a child and they can say the words that none of us who haven't can. It's been my experience. My wife and I went through a miscarriage years ago now. It's been my experience that it was a couple who had gone through a miscarriage that was able to pastor us in ways that no one else was able to. When we finally surrender control and say, God, in your capable hands, what feels like a weakness, Lord, would you remind me that you actually can transform it? That's when our story becomes really interesting. Now, there's a PS to the whole thing. So if we're filming it, by the way, that's the movie. Is that a good movie? I'd watch that movie. Because it's especially in our world of social media influencers and Instagram filters, you know what I think is going to make a comeback? Sincerity. Like, I think sincere. Like, just, I picture the ending scene being like Nellie Olson, like all of a sudden realizing that she's not a liability. She has something to offer. You actually don't have to have her say anything because it's a look, right? You can, it's a look. There's a look, my son's in tennis right now, and there's a look when I know he knows he's doing good. Like, he has a look to him. There's a look that somebody who knows that Jesus loves them, and it's, like, there's a look that they have. You don't even have to, if we can get Nellie to act it right, she probably actually have to believe it, but there's a look that she could have when someone's life has been transformed. But before the end credits roll, there's one large, like, we got to deal with it. What about all the violence? That was the question that spurred this whole thing. What about all the violence? It is a violent story. And not just a violent story. It seems to celebrate violence. So it's not just violent. It celebrates violence. What do you do with the violence? I picture Nellie asking Grandpa Clooney and him saying, I was glad you asked that question. There's two more lines to the story that matter. Here's the two last lines. That day, Moab was made subject to Israel, and the land had peace for 80 years. The word for peace there in Hebrew is the word shakat. Let me hear you say shakat. Shakat. There's another word for peace in Hebrew. It's a more beautiful word. Anybody know the word? Shalom. There's shakat and shalom. Shakat means quiet or an absence of conflict. Shakat is what happens when you and a friend fight, and you just don't talk to each other. You're not fighting anymore. It's quiet. But there's no restoration of relationship. Shalom is when there's restoration of relationship. Shakat takes the violence, it's calm for a moment, but there will be violence again. Shalom is wholeness and restoration. And just in case we're foggy and fuzzy on whether there will be violence again, notice the next line. After Ehud came Shamgar, son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Like you do. But the story is going to be violent again, and it's going to repeat. The cycle is going to repeat, which leads to a sequel. Here's my pitch sequel in a blip. Maybe it, like Marvel, you do it after the movie, like stay tuned for the next thing. Here's the sequel. The rabbis say that King Eglon had a daughter. The daughter of King Eglon, the king of Moab, according to the rabbis, was a girl named Ruth. Ruth, Moabite, will marry a guy by the name of Boaz. Boaz, Israelite. Ruth comes from the line of Lot. Boaz comes from the line of Abraham. There was a story in which Lot and Abraham divided. You take this land, I'll take this land. Lot goes one way, Abraham goes another way. In this story, Ruth and Boaz bring the tribes back together. They have a kid who have a kid who has 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 a kid whose name was Jesus. Jesus, when he leaves his church on mission, says, "My peace I leave you. My shalom I leave you." History is one giant wheel of violence. Us thinking a little more violence and we'll win this fight, and then we fall right back into the same pattern. History is one giant wheel of violence. But the sequel to the story is that Jesus offers an alternative narrative. We can break the cycle. He came to bring shalom, redemption. We're going to take communion this morning. Communion involved four cups in the time of Jesus. Jesus drank on the third cup. That third cup of communion is a cup known as the cup of redemption. Jesus, that's the cup that Jesus says, "This is what I'm going to do for you." By the way, if you didn't get one of these, let's get past it right now. This is the medium. It's a weird medium. This will be the last Sunday that we will use our medium, though we could probably use them if there's ever a zombie apocalypse, because these things will be here at the end of everything. But we get past it. Get past the weirdness of this medium to the God who's behind this medium inviting us into his arms. You'll peel the top layer off, and then you'll peel the bottom layer off. But let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll take communion together. Lord, as we come before you at the close of this service, Lord, would you remind us on this Father's Day that you offer us an opportunity to break the cycle. Lord, would you help us to step into relationship with you. Jesus, for anyone here who right now is ready to discard the whole thing because of the violence, Lord, would you remind us that you took the violence upon your body so that we could be offered peace, shalom. Lord, would we not take that for granted, especially this morning? Would we not take that for granted? We pray this in your name, Jesus. And everybody said, amen. On the night, the Lord.
As always, we're grateful that you would spend a little time with us. For more information about South Harbor Church, joining our community, or any of the things you hear on the podcast, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m., you'll find our service streamed live on both our Facebook page and on our Vimeo channel, which you can find by visiting vimeo.com/South Harbor Church. And so once again, from all of us here at South Harbor and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.